A lot will turn on what and how much the court says about religious freedom and how it ought to be protected in the context of competing considerations and competing claims.
On the feature today, an in-depth look at the latest religious freedom case to go to the Supreme Court of Canada. In the news, we set the record straight on a controversy that's brewing in BC over codes of conduct for staff at Christian schools. There's a new website for We Need a Law. We take a look at the upcoming Ontario FIPPA tour and an exchange from our answering machine.
And now, Lighthouse News. Lighthouse News is a presentation of ARPA, the Association for Reform Political Action. Here's your host, Al Sebring.
The National Post caught our attention last week with a story headlined in part, Christian School Policies Bar LGBTQ Teachers. The story by reporter Bethany Lindsay makes the case that the controversy at Trinity Western University over a so-called community covenant restricting sexual activity of staff and students to heterosexual marriage is repeated many times over in the policies of a number of Christian schools in that province. The piece quotes former Vancouver Public School Board Chair Patty Backus, who says the policies send, quote, a terrible message. Something like that, she says, just goes backwards. It's flat-out discrimination and a violation of someone's human rights. ARPA lawyer John Sycamore says Backus has it all wrong on a number of fronts.
Working for any particular private organization is voluntary, as well as attending there. And so you're not being forced to do anything unless you voluntarily become a part of that community, either as an employee or as a student or a member in some other way. There isn't a human right to work for a private religious school or other private religious organization while living however you want. I don't have a human right to get married and to be a Catholic priest. I mean, that's essentially what's being said here, is that private religious schools can have a code of conduct that rules out certain behavior that some people might consider to be part of their identity.
We link to the story from the Lighthouse News homepage. In other news, We Need a Law has a new website up and running. Director Mike Schutten.
We just thought, you know, it's a good time to review things, come up with a new website. A lot of the clutter that sort of comes when a site, the years of a site continue to move on, all that clutter is gone. It's nice and clean and neat, and the action items are featured in such a way that we hope it'll be that go-to source for people to continue communicating.
Schutten says the new site sharpens the focus of We Need a Law's mission.
This website, I think, really takes us to a position where we're trying to counter a culture, not by just criticizing the culture, but by creating something that we believe people will want to be a part of. And what I mean by that is the three initiatives that we focus on are protection for preborn victims of crime, laws that would prohibit sex-selective abortion, and laws that would take us in line with our international counterparts when it comes to banning abortion after certain stages. And the way we present those is in a positive communication method. So it's very much focused on the positive rather than just criticizing the status quo.
The site remains at the same URL, weneedalaw.ca. Speaking of We Need a Law, they're getting ready for an 8-city tour of Ontario in January, talking about a court challenge to that province's Freedom of Information and Protection of Privacy Act. Cassie Knecht is putting the tour particulars together.
Each stop will have a couple of speakers. There'll be Mike Schutten, John Sycamore, and then Pat Maloney, the pro-life blogger from Ottawa. Basically, John will be talking about the case. Mike will be talking about giving some action items for everyone who shows up. And Pat Maloney will be talking about her involvement in the case and what she's been working towards the past couple of years.
She says the tour is really about promoting awareness.
The majority of the public doesn't even know that abortion statistics are hidden. That's not part of their everyday life. They're not trying to find these statistics. But for us who are trying to do our work and trying to raise awareness about abortion and how it affects women and children and all that, it's really important for our work. So we're trying to raise awareness for the fact that the government is hiding these statistics. And if these people are sending postcards to their MLAs or their MPPs or giving them a call and just letting them know that it still puts pressure on them, then they know that their constituents do care.
The tour starts January 7th, runs through the 16th, covering territory from Ottawa all the way down to Windsor. Details at the We Need a Law website. And finally, an exchange via the answering machine feature at our Lighthouse News site. You may recall a couple of weeks ago we had a story with John Carpe from the Justice Center for Constitutional Freedoms about a court challenge his group is launching to a native smudging ceremony at a public school over on Vancouver Island. The story prompted a call from John Dykstra at Reform Perspective and a response from Mr. Carpe.
I'm wondering if he's taking the right tact here. He seems to be arguing that there shouldn't be religion in schools. And as Christians, I would think our argument would be that there shouldn't be false religions in schools. There's no neutrality. So a public school system that doesn't bow its knee to God is a public school system in active rebellion against God. So I'm wondering if our tack should instead be simply to see this smudging ceremony as one more example of why we don't want the government running education.
The caller asks whether neutrality in the public school system is possible. And I would say, no, it's not. And this is an example of why it is difficult, if not impossible, to have a one-size-fits-all public school system because of wide range of different views and beliefs on the part of parents. We've got everything from Christian to Hindu to atheist, and the list goes on. The schools have an obligation to respect the prior choice of parent to choose the kind of education that shall be given to their children. And that's very hard to implement if you've got a one-size-fits-all public school system. So we need more diversity and choice in education.
Back with more after this.
Members of Parliament and elected provincial representatives will soon be heading back to their ridings for Christmas break and some time in their communities. This is a great opportunity to connect with your elected representatives and to show the love of Christ this Christmas season. Take time as a family to write a Christmas card and hand deliver it to their constituency office. Let your MP, MPP, or MLA know that you are praying for them, and make sure you do, and encourage them in their work.
And we're back on the program. As you heard on Lighthouse News last week, a landmark religious freedom case was heard before the Supreme Court of Canada on the first day of December. Derek Ross is with the Christian Legal Fellowship. In fact, he's the executive director, and he wrote a brief for the Supreme Court on the religious freedom issues brought up by the case. We've got Derek on the line from Ottawa. Derek, welcome to the program. What's this case called? What's it all about?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. So the Tanaka Nation case, which is the very first time that the Supreme Court of Canada has heard a religious freedom claim brought by an Indigenous community. So the case arises from a proposed development of a ski resort on land in British Columbia. And the Tanaka Nation, they oppose that development on the basis that in their belief system, it would interfere with their relationship with the grizzly bear spirit. And so they feel that if this development were to proceed, they would no longer be able to engage in a number of important spiritual practices to them. So they raised that objection to the minister. And the minister did not specifically address it as a religious freedom claim. The minister responsible looked at it from the perspective of Section 35 of the Charter, which is a different provision of the Charter that deals with Aboriginal treaty rights.
So what does this case really mean for religious freedom? I mean, should Christians care about an Aboriginal spirituality case?
Addressing the first question first, what this means for religious freedom, it certainly has the potential to be a very important precedent in our religious freedom jurisprudence. And there's a number of reasons for that. One is that the case raises a lot of, I think, very important questions about how far religious freedom should be protected, especially when the religious exercise in question is seen as impacting on another person, whether it be another person's interests or rights. And in this case, the competing consideration was the right of a developer to build a ski resort. In other cases, it could be any number of things. And what the BC Court of Appeal said in the decision that this was being appealed from was that the Charter does not protect religious exercise to the extent that it requires others to act or refrain from acting or behave in a manner consistent with the belief that they do not share. Of course, they said that in the context of a specific case, but our concern was that if that is taken as a broad sort of blanket statement, it could have some very troubling precedents because inherently all religious freedom cases, if they're going to court, they're going to court because there's some competing interest. There's always some third-party interest that is seen as being in conflict with the religious freedom claim. And for us to say that one's religious freedom is automatically to be overridden if and when it brushes up against some other right would effectively mean very little religious exercise is protected. So that's one issue that we found of concern. In terms of why Christians should care about Aboriginal spirituality or religious freedom for other communities in general, for that matter, I would say that if we truly believe that freedom of religion and freedom of worship are important goods to society and important to ensure human flourishing, then we should be prepared to defend it, even if it's for other faith communities and not just our own. And I think part of that is standing up for the rights of others so we keep the door open for them and for us to have the freedom to explore important questions about a higher being, higher truth, absolute truth, and to do so without government interference. And again, I think it's important to keep in mind that religious freedom is not absolute, and we wouldn't advocate for anything and everything that is done in the name of religion to be protected. In some cases, limitations on freedom of religion are justified. But the point is that those limitations have to be specifically justified after a rigorous analysis of what the court requires traditionally in our jurisprudence, which is looking at various other forms of accommodation, minimal impairment, whether the two considerations are in fact actually in conflict, and coming out at the end of the day with a fact-specific analysis rather than simply saying, if there's a third-party interest, it automatically overrides the religious freedom right. And I think the last thing would be sort of paraphrasing Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., a threat to freedom anywhere is a threat to freedom everywhere. And I think that's especially true for freedom of religion, that when one faith community's freedom is under attack, it could be seen and should be seen as a challenge to religious freedom generally. And finally, the indigenous communities are our neighbors, and we should care about them and ought to be willing to advocate for their right to have their concerns considered in a serious and direct and fulsome way, just as we would want a Christian community's concerns to be heard.
What's really at stake in this case? If we win or if we lose, what's the ultimate outcome going to look like here?
Well, I think the question really is what kind of precedent this case is going to set. Obviously, the outcome will directly impact the Tanaka Nation, but in terms of the broader implications, a lot will turn on what and how much the court says about religious freedom and how it ought to be protected in the context of competing considerations and competing claims.
There was quite a bit of discussion in the court hearing about Section 2A of the Charter, the freedom of religion piece. A lot of folks were expecting this to focus on Section 35, the Aboriginal Rights Clause. Were you surprised at the focus of the court's questions in terms of the whole religious freedom argument?
It's always hard to predict where the court will go with their line of questioning. I would have thought there might have been more of a discussion surrounding the Section 35 Aboriginal treaty rights and not as much of a focus on Section 2A. But it was interesting that I would say the majority, if not all, of the questions from the bench were surrounding religious freedom and freedom of religion under the Charter. So clearly the court, at least in their line of questioning, which may or may not be reflected in their written judgment, very much engaged on the religious freedom questions.
So is that a good thing?
I think it's good that they are mindful of the implications for religious freedom. The lines of questioning, I think, draw some concerns about where they might be headed, but it's very difficult to gauge whether and to what extent a line of questioning is actually reflected in the judge's thinking or if they're just sort of putting questions out there because they're wrestling with something. But, you know, I think certainly Christians will want to stay tuned and read this decision when it's released.
Final question. If you could just sort of outline for us the specific arguments the CLF and the EFC made before the court today. I know it was in writing, but what exactly was in that brief?
So our joint submission focused on two main arguments. First, we emphasized why freedom of religion must not be automatically overridden if it is seen as impacting third-party interests, in this case, the interests of the ski resort, especially when those interests are not themselves charter rights. The second point that we made was emphasizing and explaining how state interference with the means or instruments, or we call them vehicles, through which religious individuals and communities practice their faith can and should be seen as direct interference with the religious practice itself. So to give an example, the mountain in question, the land in question, is not itself, strictly or technically speaking, a religious artifact as we might see it. Just as the building of a church itself is not a sacred religious act, if you view it strictly as bricks and mortar. But in reality, for the believer, the church is a place of worship and a place that is necessary for them to manifest their faith. And without the opportunity to come together and have that community, their ability to worship would be severely infringed and impeded. And so in the same way, the Tanaka Nation, I think, would take the position that the land in question is integral to their spiritual practices, so that any act by the government that would make it impossible for them to use that land to carry out their religious beliefs should be seen as an interference with their religious beliefs, even though, strictly speaking, it might not be seen that way. In the end, we didn't take a position on the remedy, and we did not take a position on whether the decision in question ought to be set aside. We left that for the parties to argue on. Our primary concern was simply that the effect of the decision on the Tanaka Nation's religious beliefs was directly and fully and robustly considered.
This has been Lighthouse News, delivering news and commentaries on today's current events to equip Christians for their task in the public square. Questions or feedback? You can leave us an audio comment by clicking on the answering machine button at the top of the Lighthouse News homepage, or you can send us an email, info@arpacanada.ca.
Be sure to join us again next week for another edition of Lighthouse News.